From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Math anxiety. It's common enough to merit a robust Wikipedia entry and countless journal articles. Culturally, it's so much more acceptable to admit you're lousy at math than, say, reading. American students consistently rank behind their peers in other nations when it comes to mathematics. Where does math anxiety come from? And how can we learn to see the beauty in math? UMBC mathematician Manil Suri shares his thoughts.
People always try too hard to make it applicable. They'll say, you know, if you do this and do that, then you'll be able to make a new transistor. Well, no one really cares about how you make a new transistor, but do we care about the infinite? Well, yes.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Today we're talking about a subject that strikes fear in the hearts of too many of us, math. In study after study, American students rank behind their peers in other industrialized nations when it comes to mathematics. Recent research from the U.S. Department of Education indicates even those scores may be slipping. Could it be we are simply failing to instill a love of math in young people? My guest today, Manil Suri, is a math professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, a novelist, a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, and a math evangelist. Manil Suri, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let me ask you the question that I just posed. Do you think American students are failing to excel at math because we just aren't getting them excited about it?
Well, first of all, let's just think about whether they are actually failing to excel in math. I know that there are all these surveys and test scores and so on where the U.S. is slipping. But one thing to keep in mind is that the U.S. is 50 different states, and some of these states are actually doing pretty well. And so I think that's always a comparison that one has to be wary about.
I have to interrupt and ask, what do you know about Maryland and that score?
So Maryland has actually raised its reading levels more than it has its math levels. So one of the things that one can talk about is whether states can really learn from each other and see what different states are doing that other states aren't. The question of whether there is math anxiety in society, well, yes, there's no doubt about it. And there's no doubt about students being differently engaged by the subject. There's going to be a cohort of students who's always going to be loving math and going to be very motivated. And then there's people who are not that well engaged. And so that, I think, is the question you're getting at. Like, what to do about students that are not that well engaged, and does that affect their performance?
I want to get back to that with you, but I'm struck listening to you. You grew up in India.
Yes.
You were about 20 when you came
exactly.
to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And in one interview I read, you said you were shocked to find how much Americans hated math. You said, quote, "You almost needed an anti-defamation league for mathematicians. People actually took pleasure in explaining how bad they were at it," end quote. Is that a particularly American thing?
It's a particularly American thing to talk about how bad you are at something. And math often ends up being at the receiving end of that. And so I think there is an effort by people who are in the math education business, especially informal math education, to try to teach people that, hey, maybe it's not okay to just say, well, I'm terrible in math, and you know what a bad subject it is, what a difficult subject it is. How do you raise how math is actually looked at in society?
Right. I mean, we let young people say, I just can't do math, in a way we'd never let them say, I can't read. It seems to me we give young people a pass on math.
And it's also something that keeps getting repeated, and they keep hearing it from other people. They might hear it from their parents who have had problems with math themselves. They might be told over and over again that they are arts people, they're not math people, as if you can only do one or the other. It's these stereotypes that people absorb, and it becomes very hard to get around them. So let's see how we can actually engage people. I mean, that's the main thing. When someone says, I'm terrible at math, it's probably the sum of various experiences. Maybe they have had some bad math experiences. Maybe it's been drilled into their heads that you can only do one or the other. So how do you stop that? And one of the key things, I think, is engagement. A lot of math education, maybe too much of it, really revolves around activities that have to be performed over and over again to master them. And that's what I suspect makes people tune out and perhaps increases the amount of problems that people have with it. Is there a better way to engage people? Some of the things that people are talking about now can really make a difference.
Meaning what?
Well, I've been to some different classrooms in the last couple of years and really seen what a few people are doing. One of the most amazing things was a classroom in St. Andrew's School in Toronto. It's a public school. It's in the middle of a very diverse neighborhood, pretty low income, lots and lots of immigrants. And what they're doing is they're actually starting at the second and third grade and teaching kids about infinity, which is kind of mind-boggling. The way they do that is they incorporate little bits of fiction in there. The one day that I went, they were talking about Rapunzel, and she's trying to get to the door, and they weave in the so-called Zeno's paradox, which is that it takes you, you know, a certain amount of time to get to half the distance to the door, and then it takes Rapunzel a little more time to get to half of what's left. And they actually look at this pictorially and show that you can actually sum those distances together and make sure that rather than motion being impossible, you know, she'll always have something left over, you can actually sum this infinite series and get a whole number, which is just one or two.
And the significance to Rapunzel of getting that whole number
is that she'll make it to the door and be
she'll
able to
escape. She'll make it to the door, okay.
Yes. So, you know, just little bits of fictional elements to motivate people can make a big difference. These kids were really into it. They were owning the subject. They were given the tools to really make math their own. It doesn't have to be 100% of the time, but if there are more flashes of that, then you can really make a difference, perhaps.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kass speaking with UMBC mathematician Manil Suri. We're talking about math anxiety, and how to enjoy math. You wrote a piece for the New York Times about falling in love with math. When did you fall in love with math?
I liked it pretty early on. I started thinking of it as a career when I was in college, and I actually was a physics major, and I talked to career counselors, and they said, well, you know, it's much better if you go in math, at least in India at that time, because fewer people do that. And I was a little leery of that. I said, well, you know, this is so abstract and unrelated to the real world, and maybe I'll be living too much in my own mind, which I do too much of already. It took me a long time to realize just how connected it is with the world.
So I'm getting the impression then that it wasn't the abstractions in math that drew you to it.
Actually, it was the abstractions for me.
Give me an example.
An example would be we had abstract algebra, which we started doing around that time when I switched. You know, you've probably heard this thing about math being a game. And in abstract algebra, what you start looking at are very abstract mathematical entities and spaces of these entities. And you set up a bunch of rules, and then you kind of start playing with these entities and trying to see what other rules they might follow and what laws you can deduce from this. And you might think, well, this is really, wow, this is like something, you know, what are you smoking and so on. But then what happened was it turned out that these very same things like group theory and so on turned out to be essential to explain what happens in quantum mechanics, for instance, and in higher physics. So even the most out there theories can sometimes have these links to what's really happening in the real world. And I should point out that there are different facets of mathematics that are going to appeal to different people. Someone else might be really interested on the financial side and say, hey, this really makes sense because I can see how money multiplies or how something else happens. I was teaching a class in algebra, and I had one example, you know, me being the anti-sports person, let's say, but I threw in one example about how you can apply the theory that we were doing to the statistical scores in baseball. And I thought, no one's really going to get much out of this. But then one student said, you know, that's the point where the whole course clicked for me. So it's quite amazing what turns different people on.
I'm trying to connect what you just said to something I read in an op-ed you did a couple of years ago for The Times. You wrote, quote, "You can appreciate art without acquiring the ability to paint, or enjoy a symphony without being able to read music. Math also deserves to be enjoyed for its own sake without being constantly subjected to the question, when will I use this?" End quote. It sounds to me as if you were just saying that it's the applications that get people excited, not the appreciating math for its own sake.
Well, that's true for some people. There are some people who will always ask the question, when will I use this? And what I was saying was there is usually an answer to that. But for other people who are perhaps never going to use this, then the question is, can math offer anything to them? For the general public, I think that what happens in informal math outreach is people always try too hard to make it applicable. They'll say, you know, if you do this and do that, then you'll be able to make a new transistor. Well, no one really cares about how you make a new transistor in the general public that much. But do we care about the infinite? Well, yes. I think that's one of the questions that we all as human beings always grapple with, more in a metaphysical way than in a mathematical way. And what I was trying to say was that you can actually get rid of the calculations, which scare a lot of people, and really get to the ideas. And some of these ideas in math can actually appeal to people. One of the ideas that I talk about in that article is that if you think about a square, and then you think about a pentagon, and then you think about a hexagon, and you start increasing the number of sides in this polygon, as you get more and more sides, what happens is your polygon is really becoming a circle. It's a neat observation. It doesn't really strike one as having an immediate application, even though I'll tell you that it does. But that's something that's almost like someone would expect in a yoga class. Let's all, you know, close our eyes and think of a polygon and make it have more and more sides and it'll become a circle. That idea was also used hundreds of years ago by Archimedes to figure out the value of pi. Because what he did was he could actually calculate the area of any polygon because it could be divided into triangles. At that time, they didn't know how to calculate the area of a circle. But by approximating it with more and more sides, he could get very close to the area of a circle and from that figure out what the value of pi should be.
We need to take a quick break. Manil Suri, mathematics professor at UMBC, novelist, contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, is staying with us. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, more on math. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about mathematics, why so many people have anxiety about it, and what might cure that. My guest is Manil Suri, a mathematics professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He has written eloquently about his passion for math for the New York Times. He's also written 3 novels, and I want to pick up on that. It's pretty unusual, Manil Suri, to be both a mathematician and a writer. Do you think of yourself as more one than the other?
I think it depends on which day of the year you ask me and which time of the day you ask me as well. One of the things I've been doing is trying to merge these two identities. So writing about math, in fact, my next novel will be about math. I think that's one lesson to take, that we all live in so many different worlds, and it's a question of how do we combine these things.
You are combining them. How?
Yes.
How?
Well, one of the things is I'm writing about math. I think I'm also able to relate more to people in the arts because I've just met so many of them. And I think that's helped in get a sense of what some of the problems are, where people have a block. And also, what's been very interesting is to see how much interest there is in math in these people who supposedly have no interest in it. One of the things that happened as a writer to me was that I went to several writing colonies. And you usually give a talk about your work, about your novel in progress. And almost all the time, they wanted me to talk about math instead. So I used to usually talk about infinity. I've done things like that at writing conferences, at writing festivals. And so that kind of mixing is something that I think we need more of.
I think I get some sense of how your knowledge of math informs your writing, although I'd love to hear you articulate that.
I think it affects it in two main ways. One is that there is a certain conciseness that you're trained to always worry about as a mathematician, and that carries over in writing. So I think there's always like, okay, is this thing really needed? Is this word optimal?
And so no flabby prose.
Exactly, yes. And the other thing that happens is that if you're looking at plots, I tend to search maybe more than I need to. In other words, go through all possible plot possibilities and try to optimize and see, you know, where does this lead me? Where does that lead me? That's another thing that might be happening.
And does your experience writing novels affect how you do math?
Well, we'll find out this fall because I'm teaching a class. It's a writing intensive course and it's on math. It's about the history of math. And so I'm going to try and teach it like a writing workshop as far as I can. And I think there's something to be said about the other part of the equation where mathematicians are actually not necessarily as immersed in skills in writing. Not always. I mean, some people are great writers, but other people have expressed this idea to me that, oh, they don't really like to write. So I would like to try what happens in that sense.
That's Manuel Suri here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He is a mathematics professor at UMBC, also an opinion columnist for The New York Times and a novelist. One of your columns in The New York Times extolled recreational math. Mm-hmm. What is recreational math?
It's little puzzles. I mentioned, for example, Zeno's paradox, but there are all these other little puzzles that have come to us through the ages. Like if you have, you know, seven balls and one ball has a larger weight than the other, what's the minimum number of times you would have to use a scale to see which one out of those seven is the heavier ball? Things like that. So they're little brain teasers and puzzles. You know, underneath them is some principle of math, perhaps, but mainly it's an idea of trying to engage people with it. There are resources on the web. For example, Baltimore County has a large resource base where teachers can actually look these things up and incorporate them into classes. That's a great way of doing things where you spend some of the class time, you know, challenging people, giving them something that's interesting. And that has several different ways of proceeding. Going back to this teaching question, I think that one of the problems I've seen is that people, when they think of math, think about getting to the right answer. That actually ignores two important things. One of them is that if you don't have the right answer, you've made a mistake and you're wrong. Well, that's great. I mean, that's what you should be actually looking at and encouraging people to make mistakes, and it's been proven that that actually increases your math capacity. I've seen this in person. One of the other classrooms that I went to was by Leslie Wagner, who's a teacher at Pinecrest Elementary School in Montgomery County, and this was an accelerated classroom. And what she was doing was actually going through something and asking the class's opinions. It was a mathematical question, and I forget what exactly it was, but part of the class said, you know, this is the right way to approach this problem. And someone else said, well, this is the answer I got. And here is why I got that answer. Now, the answer, it turned out, was incorrect. But that wasn't the important thing. The important thing was, what were the steps that brought you to that answer? That's really the key of what we need to concentrate on. Encourage people to really think of different ways of approaching a problem. And even if they are incorrect, get in tune with what that thought process is and where it might fail or where it might succeed.
It seems to me, and I certainly am not immersed in the Common Core standards for curriculum, but it seems to me that that approach of being able to explain how you got to a conclusion is part of what the Common Core is pushing. Do you have thoughts about the Common Core standards?
Absolutely. I think that it's exactly what you said. The Common Core is a way to look at these various ways of attacking a problem and coming up with the way that you are most comfortable with. Another one of the classrooms I visited was Lakeland Elementary. That's in Baltimore City. Katie Poist was the teacher, and she was amazing. She has a background in math, and she was talking about fractions, about how to add fractions. And that day, she was talking about friendly fractions, which have the same denominator, and so you can add them together. So if you're trying to add two fractions, you can make them both friendly by changing the denominator, multiplying the top and the bottom. It wasn't the best method to add fractions, but she was just throwing it out to the class. If people liked that method, then they could adopt it. If they didn't, then she had other methods that she had discussed on other days. One of the things that she told me was that one of the problems that a lot of kids have is with division. And with this new kind of Common Core thinking where you give them an array of different strategies, kids that might not have ever been able to divide, perhaps, were able to divide by perhaps a less efficient method, but something that'll still work.
Why have you been visiting so many schools?
I've been, dabbling with that kind of math education for a while. I've been just sort of keeping track of what's been happening a little bit. Some of these places that I visited was more for an article that I was hoping to write, an op-ed, and that might happen in the future.
Well, watch for it. Do you have any ideas for parents who might have math anxiety themselves but don't want to pass it on to their kids?
I think puzzles are a great way of going about things. There's especially a very well-known person who's now deceased, but Martin Gardner. There's a whole bunch of things of his on the web, some with nice animations and so on. When I wrote that puzzle column, I got several emails from parents who said that, they got one of Martin Gardner's books and the family would get together and try to solve a puzzle. So I think that would be really neat, especially if a parent has math anxiety and the kids can solve the puzzle. The kids will feel great about that.
I think of math as a very solitary project. Is it for you?
Well, it has been for me in the sense that when you're doing math research, you are kind of, really ensconcing yourself in a very lonely place just to be able to concentrate on that. But the interesting thing is, again, this is something that the newer ways of teaching math try to involve an entire classroom so that there is this give and take, there is this discussion. And I was just looking at a video yesterday. It was a TEDx talk where some kid was saying that, last year, the math that I was doing, it was just by myself. I was given these problems and so on. And now, this year, we've changed the way we are doing it. And so the whole class gets involved. And it's suddenly, I can talk to other people, explain things, and it's just so much more fun. So I think that's the other thing that perhaps, if we can somehow make it less solitary, where you're actually interacting with other people and trying to learn from their mistakes, which is very, very important, then it can really change things.
I read there's this subculture that I knew nothing about called math circles, social groups that are organized around math. Is that a way of doing that?
Absolutely. I don't have any kids, but I keep hearing about, I can't do this because I'm dropping my kid off to soccer practice or doing this or doing that. Wouldn't it be amazing if one time a week you could be saying, I'm dropping him off into a math circle? And I think that's the key, trying to make things interesting, trying to make things engaging. If you could somehow get around this notion of math being for nerds or math only being for very smart people and so on, I do think that we can make a difference, like math circles. Research has shown that in the first few years of education, kids are, reasonably good in math. There's not that math anxiety that is set in yet and so on. And so if you can start at that level and build up from that, make math more fun, make it a day-to-day activity like soccer or Sunday school, I think that could really change things.
What effect do you think technology is having on our grasp of math?
Well, certainly things like the Khan Academy, which has a lot of videos and so on, that's been great. Beyond that, I think that it's a double-edged sword. Some technology is great. Other technology might flash answers or tell you things which, you might think, I've mastered this. But the one thing that's still going to be true about math is that it does take a long time for these ideas to set in. So you can do a lot, you can have a lot of fun, but at some point, these ideas have to percolate in. And my one concern with technology is that since it's usually self-paced, you might be really thinking that, well, you've got this, but you haven't really.
So you need speed, that. Speed through something without letting it gel?
Yeah, something like that. I think math has to have a component that's completely reflective, that you're really absorbing these things. And technology, you know, has to be sensitive to that. So you need some sort of breaks almost. You don't want to speed through everything because it does take time for these ideas to settle in.
I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Well, me too. Thank you.
Manil Suri is a mathematician at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also a novelist and contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to some of his pieces about math. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.